25 years of Vampire the Masquerade presents Vampire the Requiem.
Hey folks, DJ here. I just want to take some time to talk about Werewolf the Apocalypse Retaliations by Flyles Games. This soon-to-launch game is brought to you by the same team that's bringing you Vampire the Masquerade Chapters, and they just released a trailer to go along with it. We at 25 invite you to check it out at werewolftheapocalypse-retaliation.com to catch a peek at the trailer and be updated of when it'll appear on Kickstarter, which seems to be early 2022. The game promises to have everything that made Chapters endearing to us, the fans, including scenarios, investigations, beautiful miniatures, and more. With that, thanks for your time.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Requiem. We're 25 years of Vampire the Masquerade, bringing you today a review in Requiem, as already revealed, of the enigmatic book, Seven. This is not to be confused, but what is that old phrase with seven? Why you should never trust it?
I thought it was 13.
Because seven, eight, nine.
Why?
I'm done. Podcast over.
It's so good. Well, there's a lot going on with Seven, right? I remember Requiem being launched and Seven was mentioned, and like we've reviewed, you know, we mentioned little spots in here, and there's all these excerpts of like, oh my god, hushed tones, what are they? What could they be? What is it? And everyone had high hopes because Requiem was the new vampire, right? Mm. And what has changed? What's different? And then this book came out. This is where I lost the most people who had interested in Requiem when it came out. People who were on the fence were like, okay, Five Clans, got it. A little different way of vampire. A little more romantic. A little more gothic. It fits. Mm-hmm. It fits. Seven. We're done. They were done. And I got to tell you, before we get into the book, why I preface this is because everyone who has read Seven who's chiming in is probably going, yeah. Or, I fucking love that book. What's your issue with it? And I got to let you know, I love that book. What's your issue with it? That's how I know you're new. You probably started on Requiem and never looked back. And if it's new and fresh and you never knew the game, like never knew old school vampire, you're going to be okay with it. Fits in Requiem's universe just fine. It's there as is. No big deal. However, we didn't have our hands held in 20th Vampire or before. When Vampire first launched, when old Mark Ryan Hagee got around to making that book, and it's Hagen, I know, I just said Hagee to make familiarity I don't have with him. But the point is, when they were coming up with this book, we know what First Ed was, right? But First Ed was hot. When you had it and it was new, it was pretty cool. It was new and exciting and nobody knew and all that stuff. But they weren't holding your hand. They didn't tell you, hey man, be careful, fifis, people could get offended, folks will get scared, blah, blah, blah. You had to pioneer that shit. You had to learn as you went. Strangely, people who play imagination games can get really traumatized playing something that isn't real. And that always will amaze me, right? I want to meet these storytellers who are so immersive that you don't know what's fake at your table. Just saying. I really want to get down to it, because I've never been in a game where I didn't know that I was just a dude sitting at the table who put in my percentage for the pizza and the drinks to hang out and have fun. Or, we didn't come from a restaurant to come here to show up to LARP to have a good time. And so those boundaries are there. I'm only saying it because when you get to Requiem, you could tell that the culmination of the stories and the gathered info of how this material was misused, and i.e., let me go back and defend everyone. Bob, little thick skin. I was raised that way. It's my family, my culture, where I'm from. So I'm used to jokes and sarcasm and things of this nature. You would know that listening to this podcast by now. If not, let me tell you. I don't mean in any way to offend you. If you get into something and your passion's there and, you know, the story trips you up. Everyone gets into everything they enjoy. From movies to music to entertainment has a way of titillating and bring you into imagination land. Why I'm stressing this is because you need to understand why Requiem is a gold star. Why V5 is a gold star. They have made it to where you cannot get offended by the... Or it's really hard to get offended by the material unless it was deliberate. Right? But it won't be done by the company or the authors issuing it. It's not. Now, why I say this? It's hard to do a podcast about Seven because Seven does a podcast on itself. It's such a well-written book, it stands on its own, right? It stands there. What does it tell you? Well, my favorite highlights are, number one, this book is not canon. We gave the authors carte blanche to tell three possible stories about what 7 would be in your game, but we believe and hold to the fact that 7's a mystery. They are antagonists that you don't know about on purpose, and their strength is in that mystery. We believe in that mystery. We are not helping you define what they are to your game. They're designed to titillate, to force you to give a care, to understand as to why you would use them. So to even use 7, you have to spend time to decide what they are in your troops. So I want to make that preference before we dive into specifics, which I will milk both of you for, because there's a lot of angles to go when it comes to that. The other thing to note is that, well, wait a second, that's unfair, Bob. If I bought a book, it should be open and shut about what 7's about. Ha ha ha! And it is. It absolutely is. It's fit with history. It's fit with what they're about. It gives you unique bloodlines. It gives you unique powers. It tells you where, how, and if in alternate timeline fashion. Go with one direction. It even warns you. You can't splice this up into a myriad of things. It has to go in a linear direction. So here's three linear directions. It's easy to go, now I get it. And this is how we're going to use it. But wait a minute. I didn't want to buy a book that was about antagonists only. What if I wanted to play 7 because they're familiar to me? And I'll get to that in a second. Because we got to get that poison out before we talk about the book. And the fact is you're right. But they took care of that. By them listing what powers they have and why. Again, you get to define what path you're choosing for that or create your own. And they open it up. And the three authors do a great job of doing that. They even go so far as to have the authors decide to tell you where their thoughts were beyond then. If you could, we'll go with DJ. Normally, DJ doesn't do a lot of reading here for us, and I want him to. I love his dulcet tones. do that first forward, if you could, about the I believe it's the Forgotten Cities, the title.
So Greg Stoltz goes, I actually submitted 7 possible explanations for 7. This presented 7 as the descendants of 7 princes of Irem, and the unlikely result of vampires attempting to diabolize a demon and winding up with a demon as a spiritual parasite. Merovingian kings destined to kill all vampires until Longinus embraced some of them, a covenant of kindred who believe they'll become mortal again when all the vampires are gone, and devotions do crazy 7 stuff. The results of desperate spirits fusing themselves with 2 clans that were about to get wiped out, resulting in a hybrid whose numbers are fixed and could only be put down for good by diablerie. A covenant of diablerie as a sacrament, and some unique blood sorcery, and the option that they've been broken and inferior kindred from Gamora, motivated by envy and planning to wipe out all the kindred because they can take over the world. And as you can see, elements of several of these got melded together for the final product.
What that highlights to me is that when an author goes in hard like that to explain what they wrote, at least, it doesn't necessarily explain exactly what they wrote, but gives an idea where it came from, and a quick intro as to where this idea came from, they're bringing you on board. They're actually educating you. They're bringing you in to see where their vision came from. And they wanted to know precisely what they could make of it, right? They wanted to know the outcomes and the things needed. And really, insight is the best way to put it. We'll just close it off with that. And the insight here into the Aaronites that Greg Stoltz invents is a 7 different possibilities that he couldn't decide on of what it would be. So you can almost see the assignment that was given to them, right? Your authors were writing about 7. 7's the number. It's got to be 7. It's billed at 7. Roman numeral 7. Make something of it. Make 7 somethings of it. Make something where 7 is the thing. Lucky number 7. 7's great. 7's my favorite number. And they were like, okay, 7's incredibly important here. We're going to roll with that. However, what you're going to find in this toolkit, as they refer to this book, is that they're like, we came up with an ass load of research into why 7 was important. And a lot of those directions are in this book before you read what they decided 7 was. So in this intro that I'm talking most of on purpose, because I'm letting you guys warm up the banks, I want to kind of navigate where this comes from. It may sound crazy town to some of you, what they're getting into on the Requiem end, but I need you to highlight and remember, this is not canon. These are outcomes they decided would fit in the Requiem verse, as it were, and you could use them as written. That's their point. Or make up your own. Greg hammers it home. Christopher Kobar goes over the betrayed that he created. We're not going to read that intro, but then Chuck Wendig actually has sleepers in here too, which is by far the most disturbing one, I feel, of all of them. It's an interesting concept, but it's capturing almost a different element, but still holds true to the mystery terror that each of them represent. Because I think the first entry, and that's the Akkud, is a great sizzle intro. I'm going to tell you why. And then I'm going to let one of you, whichever, or both of you, kind of dig. And what I mean by that, throw elbows to get in here in this conversation. I've never read... Here's what I feel he did, right? Whether he intended to or not. He looked at the story of the Bali. He looked at the story of the Asimites, and he saw a correlation. An easy correlation, and maybe he was a fan or maybe not. Often authors who get to write books for projects are not fans of the previous material because they didn't know about it and are given time to research and they come across it for the first time. But if you had to look at Clan Bali and Clan Asimite side by side in their inception, they strangely line up, especially when you get to the revised and they start explaining a bit more and tying in because they deliberately did it. Once that happened, they must have known the Pride Line was ending. They're coming up with something new, but they thought of something. The Asimites were great when they were antagonists. They were great. When you didn't know of them and they were coming to your area to kill you or whatever, people were shitting tiffity cufflinks to try to find out who it was. And it was a big murder mystery and don't be the guy that gets his soul late and all that stuff. And that was lost when Revised hit. You know, when it became playable characters and blah, blah, blah. People lightened up and saw a purpose and all sorts of things. We know that story. The Bali were never playable. Right, but here's this hardcore entertainment of fear and ritual and occult and all that and purpose. And all this is there. And I feel Greg sat back and said, I could do better. I could do better. There's a great story when you combine them both. In fact, they sound like the story of a clan that started with good intentions and went south, but born in a time when the rules weren't what the rules are now, and there were certain directions one could go into. But how do you make it digestible? Well, he researched it. He went back and decided in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, right, is where he went to the city of Gomorrah, to tell a tale of what it must have been like for that city, which it mirrors what fateful city in the world of darkness when it comes to, decadence.
Outside of Rome?
Well, similar, right? Roman elements I could see going in there, but Carthage. Carthage is what it mirrors, right?
Yes.
When you hear a vampiric union with Carthage and what they put in there and what they talk about, we know Bali were at the core of what was wrong with it, from Asimite references and even what other clans point out, and that was a problem. They united to crush Carthage. It had to be burnt and destroyed and salt the earth. All that fun stuff. Yeah, you figure and you wonder why, and Greg Stoll said the same thing I did. It makes no sense whatsoever. You went there to kill it, but you didn't tell anybody what happened there. There's no story to give a reason why you went there. And old Greg filled it in here for Requiem, and he said, flat out, imagine a king who was so decadent and had everything. Instead of martial conquest and stomping over the world, and which is what you did back then, he said, everybody come to me for all your trade and worldly needs. I have a badass army to protect what goes on here. But what we're going to do is we're going to live it up. I'm going to do every mortal thing possible
and
at exhaustion. Right, to enjoy myself. And once that's done, he was bored. There was nothing he could do to do it. He was seeking madness. He was actively seeking madness as a way to make his own ennui tolerable. But he's immortal. What is the life expectancy back in those days, right?
Couldn't have been long.
It's got to be long.
40, 45, what maybe do you mean 50, long? And you're venerable at that age.
Right, if you were dead at a war or a disease or famine, like, well, geez, you made it that long? Good job on you, right? This dude's sitting up there in that short amount of time and he's suffering ennui. What? What's going on here? Well, what happens is some dark stranger comes to his court and says, there's some shit you don't know. Let me show you. And he puts the whammy on the king, right? He just seduces him. And then the king's sons come out to warn him, and we know the story and where this is going. I don't want to ruin it because it's pretty, I don't want to say it's common, but you can see where it goes, right? The seduction of the king is but part one.
Yes.
Later on, the son of king of Gomorrah, because we know what happens to the city, right? But what you don't know is the three visitations from the grand voices that convince them, because I should probably explain that, at least in this tale a little bit. These sons get imprisoned because after warning their king, their father, what's going on, he, of course, imprisons them. They tell him this dude's bad news, and in their own unique way, they go about it, kind of like an Aesop's fable, if you will, of morality, is how the story's told. And they get in prison, they're done. Well, one of the sons was good at prophecy, and he says that since he's been in a lightless cell, his power for the unseen has been enhanced, and he foresaw some things, and some things were talking to him. And I was like, say what? Where was the precedent of that happen? Why didn't things talk to you when you were talking to your dad to know you were going to get shackled and slapped in a lightless cell if you didn't shut the F up?
That's not ever whenever you get prophecies. I've never heard of any actual oracle getting a prophecy at a point where it would be, like, you know, reasonable. Like, I'm sitting on my couch lounging. Oh, hey, Brentron, by the way, there's a flood coming. You probably want to build an ark.
Yeah, right? I was about
it's
to say.
It's always when you're in a dungeon or so a pit of lions.
but this is where I use that term white nonsense. Because it still didn't make sense, right? Because look at the precedent, right? All three brothers were there, and they watch it. And like, the youngest brother walks up and goes, oh, man, doom and gloom. I saw some shit. I've been drinking and smoking and faded, and I saw all sorts of shit. You don't want to do that. It's going to be bad. You're going to go to lay hands on me, but you need to try Jesus. Don't try me, right? Because I'll throw hands. And the king went, will you? Prison with him. He's talking nuts again. All right. He goes to prison. The second son walks up. He's like, hey, father. It's good you did that, isn't it? I got all my rings, I got all my gold, and just like you, Daddy, I'm following your footsteps. How's the world? Yeah, he's a fool, but out of curiosity, why is that stranger as good as we are? Isn't he living in our house, showing up when he wants to and disappearing when he likes? Don't we need to knock him down a peg? And the king went, nah, shut up, get the hell out of my room at night, and like shackled him and threw him up with his brother. And the third brother, the warrior of the group, sat back and went, that's how it's going to be, huh, Dad? I'm out here all day in this sun doing whatever, seeing people build this city, work for this city, defend it. You think you ain't attacked? You attacked by everybody who wants a piece of yours. It's wild out here. Things is crazy. There ain't no church in the wild. This stuff is deadly. Nah, we ain't gonna negotiate nothing. Everybody just go to sleep. It's cool. Have a party. Everybody goes to sleep. What's he do? He takes his best men and jumps this stranger, starts butchering his friends.
I like this guy. Right? He was not one that just talked, right? He just did. Like, there's a problem, I'm going to smash it. I can appreciate that.
But of course he lost, right? And why did he lose? Because he learned the stranger was something supernal. Now, it all but points out, stranger's a vampire. That's what we're describing here. It's like a court. It's like a coterie showed up out of the blue and said, we'll show you some things. Because they demand blood sacrifices the first thing they get in. And the king is like, unnaturally drawn to agree with everything the stranger says, and is just completely smitten with him for no reason, right, that anybody could see, and basically becomes a puppet king. Well, while they're in prison, and why I had to go through that was to point out, now we get that crazy, you know, I am the voice from beyond, and I see doom and gloom in your future, but if you accept doom and gloom, I will whoop that ass of your enemies now, not later, now. And they're like, we don't know, man, we need to talk about it, that's a little weird. You know, our brother is still saying this, and he's kind of high and doped up, and I don't know, man. Meanwhile, you got the warrior brother, who's the baddest and put in prison, who the king turned around and said, hey, man, he tried to kill you in your sleep? Yeah, go ahead and fuck him up while he's here, but don't kill him. So they're torturing him, right? And so in the same place, and they're like, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Well, you knew what his answer was. Kill me! Help me! Kill me! Do something to me! Well, what happens, right? Of course they accept. Whatever it is, we pay it gladly. And, like, the city erupts in fire and a horrible storm and smites everybody, reducing it to ashes, but not for the three princes.
Of course, they made the deal.
The princes of Gomorrah, taken out of the city and done. This is any Bible story you ever heard, right? In fact, it is a Bible story told very differently, but it is one, right? And we're cool. If that wasn't good enough, there's more. Right?
There is.
And it talks about, and I'll spare you, there's descendants, and descendants have to make decisions, and the founders die, some of them, but of course, the very rich, selfish brother, you know, the one who's like, hey, daddy, I don't think I like that he's my equal, right? That dude, of course, went back to the stranger, said, hey, boo, I didn't attack you. That wasn't me. Can I get a little sip of the good? Because I don't like aging at all. Look at this face, too pretty. Look at the other side, even prettier. And the stranger was like, you know what's better than having a king? Having a prince as well. Go on and drink it. All right, now get out of here. Get out of here, right? Now I control both.
Get that go.
And that's
juice.
What he did. But what did the descendants say? Oh, we figured you out. You corrupt as shit. We need to do something about him. And infighting erupts. Like any good biblical story. Once the infighting erupts between the descendants, it's like, now we're going to spin this story of what really happened. They try all sorts of nefarious stuff. All of that in this book. What I care about is that from this, they run across a descendant who's a badass warrior queen who is wise and descendant of the seer, and she's powerful. and she gets to setting things all right in the house. She ain't tolerating shit of what happened to anybody who ain't getting along with what ancestors have decided needed to be and straightening out. Because part of that pact was wiping out the children of darkness. That's what the pact was all about. We'll let you be here, but you have to wipe out all of them. It's not just them at court here, guys. It's all of them. And you got to do it any way you can. And they agreed. That's the deal. So that's the purpose of why they're running around whacking Kindred. But what she realizes quickly is that there's a problem. When one of your own is corrupt and they switch to Rome's side at this time to aid Rome in coming to kill your own people, she had to make a decision, and they find a demon named Shaddad. Now, we don't explain why she found a demon named Shaddad exactly, but they say Shaddad was lying around like Walmart. I'm going to point this out. Shaddad had a temple. He had a cult of people kind of chilling in the desert. Shaddad was open 24/7. Shaddad was working on Uber Eats before it was a thing, right? Thinking of how to send evil to your house with the flick of a button, right? That's what Shaddad wanted to do. That's how it's written in there to me. Like, it's open season. Because why, if you were this cult, could you not see that if we go ahead and take them in, they're going to kill us? Now, I'm not talking about the demon Shaddad alone. I'm talking about it's a cult around him. He had his own following, and they're just like going, okay, here comes this chick with this badass, weird-ass army of a cult and whatever and worse. We don't really know that, but it had to be pretty boss. But she walks in, and what does she do?
She makes a deal. She makes a deal. So, like, you were this... They had found out about Shaddad before, right? They actually tried to wipe his city off the face of the earth. It's just that, you know, centuries ago, they couldn't. That was one of the things they found that just stopped them. So now in, like, their darkest hour, they make, like, the worst freaking decision you can ever make, which is always whenever someone makes bad decisions, right? I don't make bad decisions at, like, noontime, Bob or DJ. I make them when it's, like, 1 a.m. and I'm running low on Jack. Okay? That's her equivalent of it. So the deal she ends up making is that she's going to marry this demon, but it's not like he puts a finger on it, right? What it does...
How many curves in a story have you... I can't count on two fingers. In fact, I've never heard. I've heard of Sell Your Soul, but what kind of a badass bitch did she must be in metrics and personality to go, hey, fallen angel, how about I just give you that ass in matrimony?
Bob.
And we'll make this right.
She was the prophesized leader of the seven, the greatest leader they would ever see. That the ones that gave them that prophecy were angels sent from God. Can you imagine how hyped she must have been if the voice of God is saying she's the hottest shit that this group's ever going to see?
I'm just saying, this fallen angel Shaddad was like low bargain basement from what she could have got, right? This was like low. Like, if I saw her walking the block in hell, I would think that, you know, maybe we should inform an archduke at least of what's walking through. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. No, please go ahead.
Also, Shaddad had some problem of his own going on. He also wasn't doing too good either. So this is like literally a marriage of convenience. But the marriage took place in that... she got possessed and she got turned, and what she got turned into was a vampire.
Now, we definitely gonna talk about that. Like, she got turned into a vampire. Did she though?
Did she though? There's like think ironically enough, or maybe appropriately enough, there's like seven things that differentiate them from actual vampires.
Let's not jump to that just yet. I'm just gonna put that in your head as, did she though? Right? Because long story short, this all justifies the bloodline via coup. Now, why are you gonna say it like that? Is because when I saw this book, and I'm like, all right, cool story. It's a little boring. I've seen this horror film before. Not me. Yeah, the story ain't that bad, but it's reminding me of two clans. I've been in a too hot minute to understand what's going on. What's in a coup? Oh, that's a new bloodline. That looks like it's a straight-up, fought-out bloodline. Let's see what we accoutin'. And then I got to look, and I was like, wait a second. All right, now, legitimately, this is getting weird. Because the accoutre reads like anything else, right? Tells you why they do what they do, what the clan's about. or what the Bloodline's about and how it is, much like we told you, the importance even of the symbol seven is misinterpreted, at least in this telling of seven.
Correct.
Because it's actually a symbol of Gomorrah swallowing the city pillars or whatever, and that's what it is. It's supposed to be remember that, but you're not going to know that unless you're from there. Creepy. And if you're a Roman vampire, which the Camarilla survived, at least in memory, you're going to think, oh, the Roman numeral 7 was left behind with a weird line through it, like an upside-down house. Nah, we don't think of that far. 7. All right, cool. Well, they got their own culture, their own stuff, their own things going on, but and their demons, by the way. But you know, it doesn't matter. We're cool. We're rolling through. We're like, wait a second. Now I'm looking at this, and we got our clan appearance down. Okay, we got... It didn't take you long to read it before you're like, uh-huh, survival skills, badasses. They read like Clan Asimite.
Yeah.
No lie. We recruit Clan Asimite. We got some sorcery. We got some badasses. We don't mess around. See, we say it's secondary to recruit these hardcore fighters, but we straight up believe you don't embrace frivolously. You only bring in people who are like soldiers or badass cops or special forces. We want people who are already trained to do that dirt so they can hit the ground running. Okay, cool. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Hey, if you're going to build undead assassins, I guess, you know, you're going to want to have them already built, right? Okay, cool. No big deal. But then it gets around to going, clan discipline, celerity, prastinata or prastinatia, and obfuscate. And I went, all right, we're going to have to look. What the hell is Preston? Okay, later on they're going to explain it. But then they go with a weakness, and the weakness reads, no Akud can deliberately harm another member of another Aaronite, as it's called, descendant of the Babylonian king.
Correct.
So, whether they're mortal or not, oh, that's unique. That's pretty cool. It's like a blood calls the blood thing, right? It's like we can't hurt our own lock stock, and it highlights this is not... some weird blood, nothing from blood bonding or nothing like that. In fact, I got tripped up and went, this is the freaking Viniculum.
Yeah, it is.
Now, Requiem has a Viniculum, but we're referring to the actual Sabbat Viniculum. Right? For the Vault reproduces, right? And so I'm like, going, okay, is there anything wrong with it? No. I mean, you put another label on it, but what's he justifying? No, they will not betray one another. They won't speak. To bring anyone to ruin, they won't betray anyone, they won't harm anyone, they can't do an action to do it, no matter, no way, no how. Doesn't happen. Well, that's the weakness. So that's a hell of a weakness. Alright, and obviously this extends from the deal that was made, right? You had one betrayed, and this quells all fights. Also highlights culturally how this is a problem for them.
Because they don't get along. They're not friends. Like, it even said, like, at one point, the whole clan was at war with each other, but they just used other proxies to fight each other.
Yes. Well, they jump around from this, too. It's like, in addition to that, they have unique traits. Now, they highlight... Well, before I forget that, they also point out part of their weakness, that they hear the whispers of Shaddad the Demon, urging them to acts of evil and wickedness. This is fantastic. This is great. This means that when they're about to frenzy or whatever, the beast has a voice. And it stems from somewhere. I actually was all about this. I thought this was great. This will help a lot of players have direction, because it's always like, am I the beast or am I me? And blah, blah, blah. No, you're a vampire. You're one and the same. And this is saying you're not.
Yeah. Definitely.
I had thought it was another way to interpret it. That the demon whispering to you was just trying to influence your beast to do actions. And so it was almost emotional. No, they mean it's literally talking. Right. It is talking and haunting them is the term to it. And that's what it does, urging you to frenzy and to destroy everything. However, then they go, we need to make sense of this. And Greg's like, jump on. Let's slap some unique traits on these to understand, because the presence of Shaddad in the blood of Yakud and the demon's role in the creation of the clan differentiates their blood from that of other kindred in six important ways. Let's look at that. First off, their minds cannot be read.
Mm-mm. Not at all.
Now, pretty cool. We're not going to look too much into that, right? Because demon's blood, demon's, you know, part of it spread across. All right. Horrific images and symbology, right? It says that explicitly. There's two ways you're going to do it if you try to read their mind. Either horrific images of destruction and prophesized end times, or you're going to get a picture of an image expressed as the numeral 7, leaving feelings of intense protection or what have you, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Pretty interesting. It's like a free minor ritual there that's a unique trait, not a weakness, though. Second, though, the Akkud neither provoke nor suffer from the Predator Stain. Huh. Why is that?
They ain't vampires.
That's one reason, DJ. It's also because if they're supposed to be a hunter of vampires, not of, you know, just like vampires like everyone's favorite Frog Brothers, but they are out for vampire genocide. They're not going to be good at their job if vampires will recognize them on sight.
So, nah, I'm going to foul that, Bruntron. I'm going to foul it because I completely categorically disagree. Just because a vampire wants to kill another vampire doesn't mean suddenly they don't sense one another.
No, not at all. We're also not talking about just other vampires. We're talking about a line of blood drinkers that were created by demons. Like, I'm going to...
We're talking about... But that's the point. You just said it like, well, because they got to hunt other vampires, it'd be bullshit if they were detected by them. Hmm. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. It doesn't matter if you want to go kill someone. They could still be able to detect you. It's not like they get a mystical protection.
You're right. Let me kick the cane girl out of the room real quick and get the right perspective on this.
So, because you need to attach it because it's a dangerous element, right? But being created by a demon instead of sharing the sources of other kindred, they do not seem to register as real vampires. So, right here we see they're not demons. All right? They also get an unseen sense. Right? Now, what does an unseen sense do for them?
Allows them to detect vampires.
Okay, so they can't be detected. But it allows them to detect. Uh-huh. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interested. Third, the blood of Aran is distinct from the perverse... let me double check that. Distinct from the perverse transformation of Shaddad. Gives them the unseen sense merit, of course. But the unseen sense is universally focused on vampires. But also, they can't be diabolized.
They can't be diabolized or they it's can't so diabolize.
No, they cannot be diabolized.
And even if they did, it wouldn't matter. And the reason why they can't be diabolized is because once you die, you got Shaddad waiting for you. Mm-hmm. Mouth open going, you belong to me. It's straight up Shang Tsung, your soul is mine. So even if you attempted to, back into the maw you go.
Wait a second. So that means if I join this group, my soul automatically, even though I didn't offer it, automatically goes to a demon.
That's right.
On death. All right. That's kind of a steep... deal.
Incredibly. Some say not worth it at all.
Alright, but also, you don't get a choice. I don't think they include that in the starting contract.
No,
right?
They don't.
It's not part of it. Alright, so they can't be diabolized, alright, but also they can't benefit from diabolism. Oh, they certainly can enjoy it.
Yeah.
Alright, they can kill people, but they'll never gain discipline, skills, or lower their gen from it.
They won't enjoy it as much as Shaddad will either, because he's also sucking that up, too. Yeah. Whatever you take him down is just going straight to him.
Yeah, it's sucking it up like a Slurpee. He got a really good deal out of this marriage.
And to highlight further that they're not vampires or vampiric origin, their blood doesn't do anything to mortals.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It doesn't do anything for people who are Vitae addicts. It doesn't do anything for them. It's different. It's not what it's supposed to be. To this end... when I look at the Akkud and I look at their origin story and look at what the Seven is, they virtually just... you might as well have not called them vampires. Right? They're half-demons. Yeah. That's what they are. Or they're full-out demons, is how it is. They're running around with that demon, that good-good, as certain DJ would say, depending on what it is, and calling it a day. All right. Now, why that hits me as weird is because this is Requiem. We're learning about Seven, or the Scourge of Vampires. What's going... Well, one possible story says, well, surprise, we ain't vampires. All right. Check. Well, that leaves us to only explore the other two possible angles that they have in here. Let me highlight the discipline weird. Right? I mentioned it earlier. Why it's strange is because when you look at this Preestancia, it's a kinesthetic sense, is as they call it. It is the instinctive ability to comprehend and calculate the position of one's body in relation to other nearby objects. Put another form, they turn into Daredevil.
Yeah.
Is the best way I want everybody to understand this. Is that it gives you a preternatural sense of the location of objects in relation to you. Almost like a form of echolocation without it being echolocation. You know, for D&D fans, tremor sense is what it reminded me of. Or something in that nature. I only say it that way because I'm the nerd who's been reading D&D books recently to read tremor sense, going, oh, okay, that's interesting. Can't be surprised because you sense the tremor on the ground. Well, imagine you had all these senses to help you understand when something's moving to hit you or you have to hit something. Mm-hmm. You have an your musculature has an absolute knowledge of where it is, and therefore you could make, as it says, free throw shots like it's nothing. Like 3-point line, nothing. You could throw a stick across the room and hit the heart, no big deal. Right, because that's exactly what you do, which makes these guys deadly. I would say more deadly than that is their ability to dodge. Like, it would be incredibly hard to fight any one of these on the open because of this discipline. And this discipline comes from one thing. Their founder was a seer. Right? That's what this is. Blood's mixed into this. He was seeing from something. I actually think that's awesome. This is not an overpowering discipline as much as it is a very... It's a good one. Right? Because I think it's good for the ST to deal with. It's good for descriptors. It's good for the player to feel... I have something very useful that isn't slay everything in the battlefield, but it will help you survive a combat or complete a combat in a unique way even. Mm. They have a devotion where it's basically to a follower of this power, let me try to remember it, missing by an inch is 9/10 of an inch wasted is how they put it, right? So if someone was going to shoot you, and you just barely get out of the way, it's because you suck. Huh. They know exactly how much to get out of the way at the exact angle, which gives you the impression of a shaky, jakey dodge scenario. And immediately what came to mind is that movie Equilibrium.
That's the one with...
Do you remember that?
With, Christian Bale.
Christian Bale and Sean Bean.
Right. Okay. Exactly. And that gun kata was knowing the trajectory of bullet fire. Not only that, it was training your body and mind to work as one, to know the exact angles a bullet might travel. Therefore, in close or range combat, you knew the stances to take, where to jump and twist, and spin out of the way as you play a game of chess with your own body to shoot your opponent. It made you devastating. That's exactly how this would look like, in my opinion, because of the descriptors they use. And I said to myself, okay, great. We have a super Asimide Bali clan. But let me throw that out of the way. I used it to point out because everybody said, I'm not doing this. They butchered those two. And I went, they just went back to the well and told a more interesting story based on it that you can get behind or not use it. And they even say that. I think Greg did a good job with it, which is why I started went in depth with it. But I digress. What's another family of seven? I forgot. They do blood sorcery, and I'm just going to point out that you're not going to be destroying vampires with the casting of one ritual. It's not what this stuff does. It does, will definitely ensure loyalty of a type, and one of my favorite in here, just to talk about it, because they show also the artwork of it, is taking somebody's skin to take their appearance.
Just jump right in like a flesh suit.
You take a guy, because you want to look like them, and you stuff them in a cauldron of blood, you seal it, and then you bake the skin off them. Right? You just boil it off them, and then you take the skin out, and anyone, even a mortal, can step into the skin suit ever more forward, and just assume the appearance of that person. Okay. That's powerful as hell, but the application's obvious. These guys are assassins. They got to get in close. They got to do their job. However, if you thought it was easy to kill them, if you want to make sure someone's dead... They have a power as well that if you kill the assassin, you suffer an unspeakable amount of aggravated damage. Happens to you as Shaddad smokes you himself for killing one of his own. And I said to myself, well, that's why maybe this is an antagonist book. Or maybe... Because I don't see a player... I'm a player, right? I play in some games. I would never take that power. Right? And I know what you're thinking. Why? But Bob, why would you do that? That's clearly a Doom thing. That's something for Doom's Doombots to have, right? For him to smoke an Avenger or try to, right? You want to put Captain America in traction, he jumps in, how dare he interfere with the Lord of Latervia? And so it blows up and it blows him up and he's out of the combat and Doom flies away. You'll never outsmart me. It just feels like that, which means I approve of it. But at the same time, that's like the only time you want to see it. Because like if you're a player, posthumously, what do you care if it killed the guy who killed you? You gotta make a new character anyway. And so I went, oh yeah, this book is about a mysterious group of antagonists. Not just a way to look at the powers and they help you with that. But help me out with this. If I was not a fan here, what are the two do you guys think we should, you want to dive in next that could take some of this away and maybe make it more palatable? Maybe I want a different theme.
Well, I think my favorite out of this, and it's not a favorite by a clear sight, is the Betrayed. It's the ones in the, well, chapter 2, in the middle of the book, because I am a sucker for a good revenge tale. Now, this one is, this one starts out with a brief history of an area that would be parts of the Ukraine and Russia, right? It starts out with this king who was well-educated, was well-loved, but he was born into a time of peace, which, if you're reading it, you're probably thinking, all right, that sounds great. And it is, unless you're a prince that really wants to prove himself. And in the midst of that, there comes a great scourge to his country. First, they start feeding on livestock, then they start feeding on people, and it comes to a head where he has to go to Baba Yaga to get some advice on how to solve this problem. And first off, if you guys are know anything about Baba Yaga, that's where this tale starts going downhill. No visit to Baba Yaga ever goes well. And
now, he's not saying it sucks that Baba Yaga is used.
Not at all.
What he's saying is Baba Yaga is a huge legendary figure that you ain't going to just use Baba Yaga once in some group book world. Of course it's going to be reused because it's good. Please continue. Right.
So Baba Yaga tells him, basically, she told him how it was going to play out. She told him how he could solve the problem. But she also told him that the thing would approach him, right? And not to trust him, not to trust it. However, when they burned the vampires or the upires havens to the ground and it has no other place to stay, it approaches the king at night and it says, King, I know you really seek to prove yourself, but you won't live to do it. Every man dies. I can keep you from doing that. I can make you strong enough to be as mighty as you want to be. And the king's sitting there like, well, he didn't bow to me, but he came to me for help. I'm the one in charge here, mm-hmm. and there's no problem negotiating. So what does Baba Yaga know? It turns out a lot. As you can probably guess where this is going. He doesn't embrace the king. He doesn't kill him. He makes him a ghoul. Not only does he make him a ghoul, it's as every generation goes by in this over 300 years of him being a king and taking on new names, he also has different generations of his children ghouled. Ends up being 7 kids. I think you can see where the numerology is coming into this at this point.
Yeah. Yep.
Everything is actually pretty cool. Everything's actually pretty fine. They've got a non-aggression treaty drawn up. We won't kill your vampires if you don't kill my descendants, okay? It's pretty fair, pretty even. That kind of goes to hell when the vampire has to go into torpor, because it's been 350 years and vampires do that. And at this point, the king and the king's kids have not been very... they have been fruitful. That is how I will say it. It is getting to the point where they are breeding such that the vampires can't safely feed without feeding on the descendants. And as soon as the original vampire goes into torpor, that's when that powder keg is lit. One woman is drained dry and she dies. The vampires won't pay recompense because they're like, look, who else are we going to feed from? So during the day, the king and the kids go kill one of the vampires. So what happens the next night? I'm sure it's all fine. Not at all, because that vampire had been around for 7 lifetimes. So they kill 6 other descendants, and it just escalates from there. It goes crazy until the king decides this is too much. And he goes and he drinks the blood of the original vampire.
But I think it's also worth mentioning, right? What the caveat that we're missing here is the original vampire, the stranger who came in, Mislav, I believe his name was, mm-hmm. He was cool with the king. He's like, I got to go to sleep, though, so I'm going to leave my seneschal and my children to go ahead and take care of it. And what is important about it, and the reason why the king is driven to go down into the crypt in the first place to go visit this torpid vamp, was because the deal was every full moon, it's time to go ahead and get your blood. And the seneschal was like, you know what? I don't think I'm strong enough to give you the blood. You know what? We'll have your blood another night. And he's starting to realize that he's getting weak. By the minute he starts feeling himself get older, at least that's his perception of himself getting old, and that brings him down to the crypt. But continue, my apologies.
It's true. And when he drains the vampire dry, and he turns to ash. The prince is embraced. The prince becomes a vampire, at least as that story goes, right? From there, he rallies his troops, and they go and they scourge the rest of the vampires from the city. And when he goes to find his children, his seven sons, as they're called, they've all been embraced as well. And it goes into some talk about how it was the agreement made with Mstislav that at his death they were all cursed the same. I personally believe that's not entirely what happened. I'm pretty sure he just embraced all his kids. And yeah, there's some ambivalence about how he got embraced himself, but who doesn't like a good mystery and an origin story?
Well, me. I'm just saying, I like to know where it comes from, right? I want to know, is this meat I'm eating, or is this beans craftily formed into a meat patty, right? That's just how I am. But the point here is that as I went through this and I read it, I was like, okay, I could accept that Mstislav did it, because I'm trying to figure out the point of them hunting down other vampires.
Yeah, I did too. I'll be honest. Like, I can love that they went and they were hunting down the descendants of Mstislav, because it talks about that, right? The six of the seven go off in six different directions to chase off all the vampires that left. But at what point does it become all of them? And, like, why?
Well, the reason why, right, even take that away, and I think one of the bigger things is, and you mentioned it, was there was a compact that was created between the king and the prince vampire, right, between Timofey the first through 16th down to, as he took his names, rather, and Mstislav. And the thing is, those vamps got duped. There's no way, shape, or form that guy wasn't crazy. This this reeks of, like, you know, silver fangs. This reeks of, like, Ventru over in, like, you know, Eastern Europe, and it just speaks the exact same thing, where you have a king who took the better part of a deal, where he was like, no problem, you can't harm my descendants. Everyone's my goddamn descendant, right? And even though he knows that his descendants were running rampant all over the place, no, you know, Mstislav wasn't the one to get in the way. And he decided, well, you know what? My life is much more important. I'm going to go eat my old friend of mine. This guy's nuts. His whole line is nuts. So it goes from feeling betrayed, or the perception of betrayal, to going, well, it's getting harder to hunt everyone else, but if they're in the way, you know what? Hunt them too. Why not? And it's not just one of them. It's seven different families. Mm-hmm. And this is, I like this particular version of the seven, because out of all of them, that we spoke about the Akkud in the previous story. In here, they give you seven different bloodlines. You could run your own vampire game from the perspective of the seven, and just go on a hunting story on your own. And the politics and the inner politics between them is what makes them fascinating to me. You have people who are just like, well, I just like to hunt vampires in the first place anyway. But didn't you forget your purpose? We'll get to that later. Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about it right now. Why are we doing this again? Because we can. Right?
There's a lot there. I mean, I agree with you 100%. There's another logic that I'm positive people picked up on too. We harped on the fact that in Requiem, just because a prince controls an area, it just means you're the strongest coterie to have that title.
Yep.
And be a part of it. It's not like it is old school, where it's like, you know, clandestine worldwide, we own these territories. It's not. You own Toledo, Ohio, because you can hold it down, and you're the prince there. Congratulations. You know, if you you hold what you can hold, then that's it. You get to be the guy there. So in this story, I'm like, why didn't they just settle for him in that city? Why did it go from there? And that's why, with that insight, I'm going to have to agree with you. It would have to be a madman. It would have to be they. Just why stop at one? It's like Pringles. They're all Diablo addicts or some. I don't know. You have to tweak it a bit. You have to make it your own a little bit, is what that comes down to. I don't know. Of the seven houses, though, that are the betrayer houses that are left, what's your favorite?
Ooh, that's kind of hard, honestly.
Go ahead.
DJ, go ahead.
Mine is House Alexander, because House Alexander screams out like, they'd be the types, especially if you've seen the movie Hostel, they were probably the ones that created that hound gang to begin with, right? Just because they could. And I could see that being one of the things in the background. And it's funny, because this is everyone who's coming into Requiem, coming in from, you know, V20 or from Masquerade. This is part where you start seeing some of those bloodlines, those Amis bloodlines kind of exist, that Eastern European, like, well, why are we doing it? Well, we don't care. It has almost like a Xantosa feel to a certain degree, mm-hmm. right? About the way that they go about stuff. And I thought it was colorful, and I thought I liked the way that they presented it, because it doesn't tie it to a clan. It just is its own bloodline.
Right.
So what is it? This is your perfect opportunity to play a vampire that's not tied to any one particular story.
So you like the House Alexander because to you it reminds you of that movie, that decadence, the idea of, yeah. of reckless abandon, and we have a right to do it because we have the money to do it. And therefore, correct. There's nothing you can do about it. Right? The terrifying aspect of people so rich that the rules don't apply to them, but they exactly. do to you. Mm-hmm. And you're who they're preying on. It's a very terrifying thing. Their quote, we are not the children of the night. We are its parents. We give it meaning and celebrate its dark wonders. And very poetic. I actually love the quotes and a lot of what mm-hmm. Requiem is. It's another good one that kind of tells the tale. Brentrend, do you have
yeah,
one?
Yeah, I do. It would be House Petronovich. Petronovich? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I actually got that right on the first time. These are the ones that are, to really put it bluntly, of all these seven bloodlines of nobility, these are the nobles of the nobles. These are the rulers. At least they see themselves. Their quote, which I agree, these quotes are actually pretty outstanding, is one I like a lot. The right to rule is passed through the blood, but unless it is properly excised, it may pass as easily as the blood spills from the veins of the kine. Only those who put it to use can claim it as theirs forever. They go through the hunt because they are the lords, because they should own this land.
Hmm.
At least it's my read.
I think it's a good read. I'm letting you stand on it. DJ, the last and final seven pitch, because there's only three in this book, but it's enough to give everybody to think far and wide. In fact, I want to point out, you had one that centralized them, right? Honed them to one purpose and one clan. Another one gave you seven separate bloodlines to go after, but with a purpose. What's the third like?
The Sleepers. Probably the most enigmatic of enigmatic. And the way their story kind of goes is it tells you they're... Who are the seven? Are they really a covenant? And this turns it on its head by going like, you know what? They might just not be. What if this goes through a whole story regarding Victorian science about being able to understand that phrenology was a thing? And at one point or another, someone was able to kind of tap into this phrenology, even using like psychic means. And then you kind of add a vampire to the mix who starts to understand and through a good amount of use of auspex or, well, depending or creating their own bloodline, they're able to manipulate not only thoughts on a surface level, but they could also manipulate things on a very microscopic blood level where it's so deeply embedded into you, like coding, like many things like DNA and such like that. They play around with it and it turns it into heads and makes you a sleeper. Yeah, a sleeper agent, right? It creates you into a Manchurian candidate, in which the point is there is a program that's built in to find and purify the vampire race, for lack of a better term. Get rid of those that are sinful, find those that you could convert, or if you find those that don't make any sense at all, let them be, because at one point they might be a potential for either or. And this one part, and it's as simple as this, folks, because that's what makes it scary. The fact that you're not taking a look at it as like, you know, some old city, you're not taking a look at it from people that were betrayed. You're taking a look at vampires who decided they're going to play a game in terms of seeing whether or not their experiment's going to work. And this experiment has been running. Running so much, in fact, that there are many things that are also innate to the blood that capture people off guard. You know, it's like, who can you trust? Who don't you trust? Are you who you are? The loss of identity is probably the scariest thing in the book, because we could be playing a game right now and Brentron's character will simply pick up a cup, walk it over to the other side, and as he places the cup down, the doors shatter open and someone comes out and he's like, but I didn't mean to do that. But he did. Somehow he did. And I think it's the loss of control that makes this portion of the story scary. Not knowing whether or not you're part of that sleeper cell. Not knowing whether or not any next motion that you do will result in the ultimate destruction of someone or the conversion of someone else.
I adore it. Why I like this is because, again, it stands on head the idea of the seven. You don't know what they are. And when you put this here as we took it farther, me and Brentron did. We were talking about this film or the project. It's pretty infamous. MK Ultra. And how they throw this in there. Now, what is MK Ultra? What would you describe it as, Brentron? Be concise.
MK Ultra was a government operation into researching mind control in the late 60s, early 70s.
Right, LSD was a massive curiosity as to what it could do to broaden eyes, and remote viewing was a thing. All the countries got on board with it, particularly, I believe it was Cold War is where it started. Nobody mm-hmm. wanted one to have an advantage of the other, and they heard that it could do this. And this is where you heard about hippie cults in the desert, tripping balls, DMT, all that fun stuff. And there have been a lot of horror films that have used it, but then to note that this happened. Or if you saw the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats. right? So you could get the trope that go with it, right? However, combine that to the World of Darkness, and you get the brilliance of what this author went with. The aspect that what happens when Kindred get a hold of it. Exactly what DJ said. You have elders sitting around, and we heard this old school trope about, you know, oh, we sit around Elysium and we play chess with mortals. Yeah, that's creepy. I bet it's creeping me out. Pawn takes rook, king, four, whatever. However, when you're like, hey guys, on Elysium tonight I present you Petro. What does Petro look like to you? Describe it quick, Neonate. It looks like the guy from Subway who delivered a sub, I guess, to the hotel downstairs. It would seem that way. But where's the condemned? And the prince is like, yes, bring him out. And they unstake some offending person who's like, I get out of it if I just say this word? Yes. But precisely this word. To him. And he walks up and says it, and Petro rips him apart with his bare hands, and he's just immortal. And to everyone's senses, this would-be fighter who did something wrong with the prince, and everybody knows of his notoriety, it doesn't matter. It didn't matter how strong he was. It didn't matter how fast he was. It seemed as if he was frozen in place, his limbs were slowly bent backwards, and the mortal, the subway guy, didn't even raise his hand. Just staring at him, nose bleeding, bones breaking, and that person was no more reduced to the ground. And then you had a very satisfied whoever turns to the prince, and I present to you a project well done then. All right, to you, the domain, it's conceded. You succeeded where the other has failed, but it doesn't. But don't explain anything else to the court. Here. Right? Because the potential is that somebody knows about one guy here. We don't know what that is. That's mystery enough. But presented in another domain or another game is this hidden killer. That it, there's no word needed. For whatever reason, the rejects this guy had, he just threw away or believed he killed them. And you could tell a different tale entirely, right? I mean, this is endless. You could constantly have something off of this idea. I mean, Project Treadstone, if you're a fan of Jason Bourne, right? Why were they able to keep the Bourne ultimatum? You know, you come after me, I come after you. Why? I'm Jason Bourne. I don't know why I know every martial arts in the world. I just do, right? Okay, seems cool. Matt Damon wins, right? And that speaks to this, and it works. We love this stuff. We eat it up. But they remind you here, the author reminds you here, that you often overlook what enhancements a kindred could actually give to a mortal. We mentioned it already in the previous description of Seven. Brentrum pointed out how it seems like you have Eastern European descendants of supreme arrogance and royalty remind you of the Zemis. But if the Zemis were labeled out in the families they were, whatever, they also remind you of House and Clan Tremere in a lot of ways as well. Right? Which is cool. So you have some love there to, you know, Easter eggs calling back to some cool stuff. Well, here you have these guys, and they don't remind you of anybody. They don't remind me of, not even Malkavian. They remind me of people who, mortals are pawns. And they're literally sitting back going, what could we do? And then I think to myself, and I'm like, it is Zemisi-esque, but on a terrifying level. Like, you would never know when one of these dogs were going to decide to jump the leash and butcher people. And there are a ton of movies that have it. Jet Li was in one. I forget the name. I think it was Untamable or whatever might have been it. Where he was
a... Chains or something like that. Yeah, with the collar around his neck. And once that collar would come out, he would work.
Yeah, all sorts of ideas, right? And for me, it's like endless. Like, I could think of all these stuff that you could do with it, but it gets creepier. And one of the pieces of artwork in here that they have is right where they talk about gathering intelligence. Let me see if I can hammer down this page number real quick. We could all share with me here.
138.
Yes, page 136. This frightened me. Now, my hat's off to the artist, the way they drew it, and I'll tell you exactly why it does. When they mention mind control, you want to think kindred, and I think players give too much credit to dominate. Dominate is literally using the raw intimidation of the beast to where your words would not be defied out of the innate fear that exists in mankind of what predators exist in the dark, right? That's what I always feel, that they're talking to that inner fear forcing a result that's indisputable. They can't even think about it, and they often want to forget it was even done to them. That's one angle. The softer things interpreted as well. But this looks like to me that it's a mortal that someone tampered with. And it's a mortal that drew to this person in its greed and enjoyment and indulgence, whoever it chose to, in a flop house. And it looks like a king sitting on the throne with whatever hellish wants. It's a sinister picture, right? It could easily be a ghoul. who everybody thought didn't have anything, and this is what it does with the herd during the day. Right? It doesn't have to be any of that. It could be all of those things. It could be a vampire from the project or none at all. But as I sat here and looked at this, reading through the section, it felt like it belonged in this section to help your brain hammer home what they're trying to come across. It's exactly what you want art to do in a book. And it did that for me as well.
Yeah. On that note, the I love the art in this book. There were several parts in my that my my like action movie itch was scratched by. Like there's one where they're busting through a window and you get some people crawling along the walls, other people like fanning out. I think I was a big fan of the art in this book.
So if I were a betting man, and I'm going to sit back as a storyteller, and I have this book, and I have Belial's Brood book that we have yet to dive into, but I definitely have this book. Off of the few mentions it has of Belial's Brood in here, what do you think is a better antagonist for your book? Let me add further. The malleable toolkit that 7 book is, to make of what you will of it, with some hard suggestions of what 7 can be, or would you prefer a more Infernus style boogeyman?
It would really depend on the story I'm running. If I'm running a story that builds a lot on subtlety, on paranoia, I would go with 7. However, Belial's Brood is a good for most chronicles, in my opinion. And in the games that I've run, I've used Belial's Brood before. I've never actually used 7 before in a game. I never felt like.
What about you, DJ?
Because
you never felt.
Yeah, I never. At no point running any of the games that I feel like 7 was a good addition to the story. I feel like they're very specific.
Okay, now hang on, because that's unusual to me. Now I saw the look at your face too, DJ. It seems to me 7 be up your alley, because I know the type of storyteller and player you are. You tend to be action based. Sure. And, you know, like that sort of thing. Why, as a storyteller, though, as a player, maybe, but why as a storyteller, you... Nah, not them. When you go in other avenues.
When I would want to run a 7 story, it would want to be one that is incredibly based on, like... it would almost be like Atomic Blonde, right? There is a lot of covert action. It won't... A lot of the action that happens will be quick, and it'll be after a prolonged period of people figuring out, like, doing an investigation. It'd be very conspiratorial.
I like that. What about you, DJ?
I agree. But that's my alley, though. I love conspiracy a lot more than... And at this point, right, especially if I'm taking it from the point I just bought it right now, this book versus the one-dimensional Infernalist, I'll take this. After having read this, I like layers. I like the sleeper cell. I could see myself, especially... It would be great if, like, Bob ran a game and we got to the end of it, and then Bob goes like, oh yeah, Red Room 25, Apricot, and all of a sudden my character, you'd be like, DJ, your character's... I was like, what? Mm-hmm. You're telling me this entire time I was a sleeper and you didn't even let me know this was happening? That would be a bombshell of a thing to happen, right? Or even playing, as I was mentioning, I think when I was reading The Betrayed, you could ignore the rest of Requiem and just run that story from their perspective alone and their hunt towards something else. And you could see what the inner clan politics or that inner bloodline politic would be like. I found that most appealing. And sadly to say, I think the only one that didn't really capture my... it's either it didn't capture my attention because it was very well written, but I thought the one that we all saw coming was definitely the Akkud. So that's why I'm more interested in the... I was like, I saw that coming, but I didn't see the Betrayed and I didn't see the Sleeper coming. And I could see the Sleeper being the most impactful and the Betrayed being the one I would probably run for all other players.
So I'll tell you my great excitement for Requiem and the campaign I ran, how I did use 7, just because I did use them. The whole factor was that I wanted the players to be important to the hierarchy, and that's kind of what they did. But they didn't want to be high up, just movers and shakers called upon, like, you know, have hound roles and things like that. And of course they did. And when they had it, they're the ones doing investigations on behalf of the court. And one of them, Maxwell, was Prince, of course, and you had all the favorites, right, because we were used in Chicago. One of my favorite was the fact that we sent off a couple players as hounds to go investigate a aftermath of a 7 scene. Well, it was great to walk in there and put the numeral 7 on the wall, and it was in blood. It was even greater the fact that there was a Roman excerpt, like an actual piece, slapped in the blood that someone grabbed and picked up. And what it talked about was the actual orders to assassinate Caesar, right? Which a lot of people are like, wait a second. how does that work out? Like, Etu Brute, all that. That was a thing that really happened. And they started looking at it, and the players, of course, looked it up and talked to a guy or two that knew a guy or two. And then started tripping around going through it, another kill happens, and another kill happens. And what was going on with 7 and how I used them is that I didn't explain a goddamn thing of what that stuff made. I let the players tell me what 7 was doing. I had this book, and I went with the exact thing it said in there. It was one sidebar excerpt that I loved. 7 are bullshit.
Yeah.
They are completely false. They do not exist. And what I did was I had Solomon Birch use 7 to clean up the area, except to put a caveat. There was a member of the Lankea Sanctum, a player who was in the confidences of Solomon Birch and actually investigated and caught Birch telling the guy to go out with the claws and commit another 7 killing. You know, violating a whole bunch of law to scare this Crone member, the new one, into coming into the fold of the Lankea Sanctum because she's from Italy. Warned that there might be some things and blah, blah, blah. And what it is, she had some backgrounds or whatever. And this woman was a player, by the way. And we never got that far. But what I enjoyed about it was that immediately he went, well, Birch, what's to say that you're not going to kill me next? He goes, I'm not, because you're one of the 7. He was like, what do you mean? He goes, 7 members, 7 numbers, 7 claws. I need all 7 of my hands, right? And had talks like that, he felt so uncomfortable sitting at the table with the other players that eventually he told them out of game what happened, but that's what condemned him. When he said out of game what happened, my real plot was that Birch wasn't just afraid of getting caught. He was afraid of one group in particular, Belial's Brood, finding out of the ritual slayings because it went against what they were trying to do in the thing. And this led to a lot of high politics, except for the fact that I also added the double entendre that the 7 was real.
The 7 was real.
There was a member.
Their name.
The 7 is real. There was a member of the Akkud who was hanging out with the coterie and served to, and it's cheesy as it gets, as a retainer. They couldn't detect him. He knew who they were, and he was walking around with them doing an investigation. And if they had paid attention, if they had done one thing, and I love this scene, they walk in and they're determined to find out, well, how did he die? What happened in here? And strangely, the hotel manager who's standing in there is giving a lot of info of what could have happened. And it's the hotel manager, well, because he's the Akkud who did the killing. And he's sitting there. Now, what was ironic was that the claw who didn't do the killing was the one that nobody could find because he took a plane ticket thinking Birch killed that guy because he was late to the meeting. And, you know, they could have found it out because that was somebody's sire. In the group too. So basically, I had plans within plans to make it entertaining and all these outs for players to use, but players get hyper-focused when you give them any numerology, any weird symbol on a wall with a weird book, and players will not give it up. And so when I say here, when you use this book or any book like it and you go with that angle, don't fall, because that was bad. I fell into a trap, my own trap, right? Story sounding good, I should have wrote it, is how I felt. But when you leave it to player reaction, it was more entertaining to watch what they did with it. And that's when I realized I missed a real opportunity. I could have actually used, because I wasn't big on using player ideas for my plot. I'm not going to mod my plot. It is what it is. I wrote this out. If they find it, they find it. If not, it moves on and it closes. However, never forget, your players are dictating when they're telling you in certain phrasing what they want to see, what they would like to experience, and they don't even realize it. Man, I wish I went with the idea they were talking about. I had people talking about that it was a hidden Roman bloodline from the Camarilla days that nobody knew about, that did all these rites and rituals. I was like, we could make that up.
We could do that.
Right?
If there was the Ninth Legion.
I thought immediately of the Ninth Legion, and they vanished. And I was like, what's to say there wasn't the Seventh Legion that went to find them? And I immediately went there with that, and I had that plot written down. I was like, they would know I stole it from them. I can't use this. I'm unique. Right? I should have totally used it. It would have been a lot better.
Like, sort of like how I'm going to use that now, Bob. Thank you for that. Also, thank your players.
I hope everybody uses it. I think it'd be awesome, right? It's a good way to do it. But I digress. Ultimately, I know this book is good. But like I said, I feel kind of weak-hearted about even reviewing it because it reviews itself. They set you up for what it's about. The authors talk to you. It's like they're in the room going, we know what this is. You make it what you will. It's an awesome book. You're going to enjoy it. It's impossible for you not to like it, right? When you can adjust everything and they put it in there, no, seriously, adjust it. We had all sorts of ideas in our head, but we, you know, crunch time, we had to go with what we chose. Oh, surprise, they also put in the book, hey, later on, this isn't canon. Like, you're not going to see this in the book as definitive. There will be changes, they will alter it, you know, to fit whatever, but don't be hurt about it. Make it good for you. And here's a book where you have a starting point and end point to always do that. Yeah, fucking bravo. Write all the books like that. I think that's fantastic.
Well, they tried, Bob, and it failed. It was called Gehenna. But that's where I think it's cheeky is because when you read this book, right? You know how we're always like, everyone wants the Baba of like, give us the canon. This book makes you forget about the canon itself because each one of these stories are so good that you could easily pick it up and walk away with it. And even forget the fact that you were given multi-options where you were given it before in Masquerade and you kind of had resistance towards it. Here, you literally pick it up like a toolbox and you're like, yeah, I'll take this with me and just walk away with it. And that's where the inception happened.
But thanks, everybody. Thank you, too, for coming out. I always enjoy this. I think Seven's a fantastic book and said that. Our next book, is it Belial's Brood?
Do you want it to be? It's Invictus.
Don't you be skipping stuff.
The next one's Invictus.
I was about to say.
Okay. It's Invictus. So my day's almost there. Yeah, Belial's Brood's what I wanted to review Requiem before. I already love that book in advance. I read that the most. But it'll be fun to read it again. Invictus is also a good read. What I like to call what Ventru should have been. But that's and what they could be in Requiem because they're still around. So anyway, I digress. I keep fucking bringing more swearing and coming up with more stuff. But enjoy that one. I don't think I do it enough sometimes. Thank you, Brennan.
Yeah.
Thank you, DJ. And thanks everyone for listening. And we'll see you for next record.
Thank you for listening to our 25 years of Vampire the Masquerade podcast. If you liked what you heard, please reach out and let us know on Twitter. At 25 years of VTM, at our email, info@25yearsvtm.com, on Facebook, at www.facebook.com/25yearsvtm, or on our website, www.25yearsvtm.com. If you would like to support us, we can be found at patreon.com/25yearsofvampirethemasquerade.